Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Welcome and hello. That was my mom couldn't make it for the audience. That was just my granddaughter, Claire. She's nine. She's a really enthusiastic kid. Thanks, Claire. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. And I've mentioned this before, and I will for a little time to come, that the grapevine, which is our meeting in print, and that was through the auspices of the GSO. That's not the KGB, but the General Service Organization of Alcoholics Anonymous, has produced a sponsorship book. It's called One-on-One Sponsorship. This is the first time they've done this in 78 years since their inception. So they're coming around to the idea that sponsorship is coming back to the forefront of recovery. Yay, and we couldn't be any more excited for this turn of events. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. They support what we're doing. They feel that we're doing a good work, and we are. And to prove that, they give us this time. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe that families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the country. So does the nation. So does the world. My experience is that the reason why the drugs and the alcohol are so prevalent today is because children have been brought up without correct principles in their home. It takes two paychecks for most families to survive. So mom's not home. Dad's not home. The kids are living on the latchkey. They're growing up in gangs and groups, and depending upon the school to teach them morality. It's not the job of the school, although they'll pick up whatever torch when you put someone else in control. Believe me, they'll take it over. So these principles are not being taught. Harold goes into the prisons. When you go into the prisons today, the majority of the folks in the prisons are crimes of opportunity fueled by drugs and alcohol. And these are the kids that did that. Now, we have career criminals. You know, some folks, you know, we have horse thieves. They're looking for a free ride. That's just the natural scheme of things. But that's not the majority, not by any stretch of the imagination. This is drugs and alcohol. It's a plague in the United States, particularly through the whole world. Drugs and alcohol are coming more and more to the forefront and then fuels the other addictions, pornography, and gambling, all these distractions are taking us away from a spiritual concept that we used to have. We're moving further and further away from the life in the spirit and more into the temporal. That means more and more into drugs and alcohol. Because Dr. Carl Jung was a noted psychiatrist and part of the beginnings of AA had mentioned that he believed that alcohol was a lower form of spirituality, and that the alcoholic was no more than looking for a spiritual connection with God, through medieval language, a connection with God. So you could see where man is trying to get closer to the spirit, but looking for that shortcut. A shortcut to the road of happiness is just a detour on the road to misery. Harold, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Joseph. Thank you for that nice introduction. And I agree totally. What I find is that families, even families where there is one parent staying at home, seem to somehow have gotten away from structure, house rules, limits, boundaries. Kids really want that. And also adults who have been involved in an addiction of some kind, whether it's alcohol, drugs, gambling addiction, sex addiction, rageaholics. We're all suffering from an escape from reality, and I believe it's a search for God at the wrong address. And so I come in and work because there's such a lack of structure. The kids have replaced the warmth of the kitchen and family togetherness with the mall and Cinnabon and Orange Julius. And so predators are preying on our young people. There are many stories about, and the news broadcast 2020 episodes about girls that are that go to the mall after school every day, and young men have learned that they can entrap these girls in a form of sexual slavery. They sleep in their own beds, but they work for these boys and young men during the night. And there, as a result, there are more slaves today than ever in history. And during the peak of slavery in the Deep South, the average age is age 12. So it's called human trafficking now. We've really got to be aware of it. And the whole thing is, as you said, fueled by drugs. And alcohol is a drug. Alcohol is a drug. The most dangerous drug, in my opinion. So anyway, I want to just mention to our audience also, in case they aren't aware, that this website, rumradio.org, and our program, Rum Radio, are dedicated to public service, and they are not money-making ventures. In fact, Joseph has spent thousands on establishing the website and keeping the radio program going. He doesn't make a penny. This is his way of giving back, my way of giving back, and also for our guest tonight, Bob, this is his way of giving back. So I just want that to be clear, and I want to appreciate Joseph for all the work he's put into this and continues to put in. It's my privilege to be here, and so I'm looking forward to hearing our guest speaker tonight. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Before we get started, I always like to say this is not AA. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I had mentioned that. This is not NA. This is not CA. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem, no one will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you make it for the whole hour, you might think it's Narcoleptics Anonymous. No, you should. This is Rum Radio. We use the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, because that's the text that created all the 12 steps. That's where the original 12 step is found. And I like to use the template, although Rum Radio does that format also, but it's more of a 12-step sponsorship. So you could plug in any of the basic text. Pardon me?
Let me interrupt for just a second to remind our listeners that I've got the chat room open. If you want to chat and ask a question
or make a comment, you go to rumradio.org, click the live button in the upper right corner, and you can find our chat room.
And the phone number is?
It is 949-534-0621, 949-534-0621. Or you can go on the internet to rumradio.org. Click the live button.
Thank you, Harold. Yeah, I always forget that. Usually you're welcome to call in if you have any questions or comments. You're welcome to do that. Most of the people that listen to the program are archival listeners. They'll come in on their leisure and they'll pick it up. And we average between 1,500 and 1,700 listens from there. And we don't know how much on the AM radio when it goes out to Nashville, Alabama, and Kentucky. They don't keep a list of that. So, but we're all over the world. I mean, Rum Radio is picking traction up. And it's a good service. It saved some lives I've gotten to know personally. And a good sponsorship, Bill W. said, good sponsorship can mean the difference between life and death. Yeah, and good sponsorship is the key. One alcoholic talking to another, one drug addict talking to another. That's the key to this. The one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. That's as simple as it gets, folks. If you missed it, that's what it is. It is really, and the rest of it is growing spiritually on a daily basis. Okay, so I'd like to start this with the third step prayer and how that comes about. This is found on page 63 of the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, how it works. And the third step prayer is also called the surrender prayer. And how I get a sponsee. Not every time. Some people come and ask me, and that's the way the general agreement is. But the big book actually says, I believe on page 93, go find a prospect and start working on them. Prospect is a sales term, some with the potential of success. And as a sales on a sales term, what you do is you qualify the prospect. And it's good for you and good for him to find out. I catch them early when they get there, what they call a desire chip or a beginner's chip. It's an outward sign of an inward commitment to try our way of life for 24 hours. So he's gotten his chip, and I believe it, men with men and women with women work the best because you can relate better to same gender. One, two, it's a very intimate relationship with sponsorship, and you don't want to. We don't want to have that intimacy misconstrued. There's enough hoops you're going to have to go through. Romance kills everything, just in case you have that in mind. But the key is, if that's the way it goes for you, it's okay, as long as you're working the steps and it's working for you, it works. You could always change your sponsor if it's not working. And so I grab the guy right after we have a prayer. We usually have an opening prayer, which is called an invocation, and a closing prayer, which is called a benediction. That was an original AA. This is one of the things that have formed since the beginning. It's okay. I think it's a good idea to do that because it's a spiritual program. And after the prayer, usually the Our Father or one of the other prayers, I grab the guy and I ask him, have you had enough? And if he's had enough, he knows exactly what I'm talking about. If he's curious and he goes, well, what do you mean enough? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? Yes. Some people, I've had people say, no, I haven't had enough. Okay. Keep coming back, and I think that's when the appropriate response is, or he needs somebody else or you sit down with him and you can have the chat. It's in the big book on working with others in seven. You have a nice chat. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So there's a little format in there, and you explain a little bit, but you let the other guy do the talking if that's the case. Let him do the talking. He'll tell you what it's going to take for him to get this. Because you telling him how smart you are is not going to turn his key. He's got to tell you what his deal is. And if you're there to listen, he'll appreciate that, and now you got something to work with. But if he says yes, I ask him, Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. At this point, they're pretty well in pain, or it's a nudge from the judge, and he's willing, he's going to go through this anyway, so he's willing to go through it. You're willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. Okay, I got my two affirmatives. Okay, I give you, okay, and then I carry Clancy Eyes, 7 questions. It's on the website underneath the sponsorship tab, how to find the sponsee. You scroll down, it's all in words, so you can do a cut and a paste and print it out. Carry it with you. Stephen Covey said, luck was nothing more when preparation met opportunity. So you're prepared. And the student will appear when the teacher is ready. And I canned them out, and I said, look, okay, first thing I need you to do, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I need you to do is to answer these 7 questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call. Simple. So next day comes, I get the call. Okay, he's taking simple instruction, and we're ready to go. How he answers the questions, really not that important. Might give you a little insight, but he's taking simple instruction, and he's qualified himself as a prospect. Now he's a sponsee. And the first assignment I give him is you got to get a home group. The home group is, these are all suggestions, though. Let me remind that. The cornerstone of recovery is free will or agency. We don't tell anybody what to do. We make suggestions. A suggestion is a subtle command. I like to think of it as jumping out of a plane, and you have a ripcord in your hand, and the suggestion is pull the ripcord. Now, if the person, if your sponsee, does not want to pull that ripcord, you know what? He's not going to pull that ripcord. Let him go. Go to the next guy. So, okay, he's ready. He gives you the questions. If you don't get the questions, 2 things have happened. He's either not ready or he's not ready for you, which is okay. Not every guy is going to go for mine. I'm a little aggressive. I'm a little bit more than most. Some, and I think it's easy when you get them early, before they languish with bad thoughts and ideas and they start getting relaxed in the room, the pain starts going away. They get harder to work with. You get a pink cloud coming down. So I try to catch them before the cloud. I use that pain as fuel to get them through the steps in a timely yet thorough manner. And so I got it. So I get it back. And then the first thing, you get a home group. In the home group, I want you to get about as many men's names as you can and get permission to call them. You usually have newcomers pack it, or if not, go to the meeting early and have them pass around a piece of paper asking for men's numbers. So he could call. He's got a lifeline now and a home group, and every day for the next 30 days, I want you to call and ask permission to recite the third step prayer, found on page 63. And the reason I do that, I tell them exactly the reasoning I do anything, how that connected up with the steps. And the reason is it gets them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. It connects them up with his fellowship. They get to know his name, and he gets to know their name. The third step prayer encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps, also called the surrender prayer, because this is a surrender time now. We surrender to win. And fourthly, the fellow he's calling might have been thinking about taking his first drink, his first hit of crack, his first of whatever, and he probably will not. No guarantee, but you got your sponsee already into service. This is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
All right, Harold, I can always count on you. Well, tonight we have one of those special guests. I like to think we have interviews. If you've been following us, we have people of note and just regular Joes. And the reason we do that is that the people of note usually have better jokes. But the regular Joe is also a miracle. And who could put a yardstick on a miracle? But tonight we have one of the when it was the kind of a celebrity. I would say, yeah, Bob's a celebrity. Bob Hayward. He's written a book. Was it The 13th Step? So we're going to hear about his story. Bob, say hello.
Good evening. It's a real honor for you to be allowing me to be on the show tonight.
You're welcome.
How about that?
It's our honor. It's our honor, believe me. So tell us, what was it like? Okay, so now give us a little background on who you are. And
okay, I grew up in Southern California, and I am the perfect example of the fact that there is no perfect example of an alcoholic, because I come from a family of 10 kids. My parents, if my dad was still alive today, he died at 92, maybe 8 years ago. My mom's going to be turning 95 in a couple of weeks, and they stayed together the whole time. I honestly never saw them fight the whole time growing up. We had like a Norman Rockwellian family. Everything was, you know, I had no excuse whatsoever to go out and get loaded. And nobody else in my family did. To my knowledge, there was no history of it, you know, until I found out later. But everything, you know, this perfect, idyllic childhood. But at 14, I was at the Indian reservation, and we were camping at this one section, and late at night, I'm laying in the cot, and I heard all this noise going. I couldn't sleep, so I got up and walked down, and I ran into a group of guys, a group of Indians, sitting around a fire drinking. And this is, I was 14 years old, never even, I mean, I'd seen people drink beer. My parents, they might drink a beer, you know, once a month or something like that, and they would never finish it. So I wasn't, not into, I didn't know the alcohol, I didn't know anything about it. So anyway, I said, yeah, I'll, you know, have a beer. And when that first beer hit me, I mean, I found God, as far as I was concerned. My entire life changed, because I was a very shy person, you know, 10 kids in the family, you know, and I was number 9, so I was a pretty shy person, pretty wimpy little kid, and so I kind of stayed in the outskirts of life. This beer brought me to life, and I mean, I said, this, I found it. This is going to make me alive, and it did. You know, the problem is with drugs and alcohol with me is it did everything it promised, you know, for a season. And it made me everything I wanted to be. I was big, strong, tall, sexy, mean, tough, everything that I wanted to be. All of a sudden I became after my first beer. And I fell in love. That night I fell in love with alcohol. And interesting thing about that particular incident was the next morning, or actually afternoon, I crawled out of bed with a hangover. I partied with them the whole night. And the next morning I walked up there with a throbbing hangover, which was really new to me, and I went up way upstream, and I was sitting on a rock, and an old Indian medicine man came down, and he just seemed out of place at this particular area, you know, and he started talking to me like we were old friends, and we got to talk, and he started giving me things that were going to happen in my life, and I, you know, I was so hungover, I didn't want to hear it, and went on and on about the things that were going to happen and that I was going to throw my whole life away, and I had two paths to take, and I was going to take the wrong one, and I would be sitting in the same spot one day dying, and I would have to make a decision to live or die. So I forgot about that whole incident. And so I went through, I immediately, my life changed. I became the terror at home, which was very, you know, the family couldn't figure it out. They didn't understand, you know, what was going on. And I found out real quick that using drugs was fun, but if you sold them, you were it. You're the cat's meow. You're the guy who gets all the girls, who meets everybody, who gets all the respect, and gets money. Money was something that was completely foreign to me, more foreign than drugs. So I immediately became a drug dealer, and that evolved into manufacturing and smuggling. I mean, I went as far as you could go to the depths of the bottom of the barrel. You know, I'm the guy that was every father's daughter, you know, every father's enemy to date his daughter, because I did everything wrong, and I knew it. I knew the whole time. You know, I tore up my family. I was being bused to a Catholic school, and I blew up the bathroom so that I could be kicked out. So then I went to the local school, public school, so that I could sell drugs there. And my life just, for 26 years, my life spiraled around and around and around. And I did every type of drug, and I always fell back on alcohol. Alcohol was my first love and my last love. It was always, you know, I could get strung out on every kind of drug, and then I could cure if I was strung out on coke, I could cure it with methamphetamine. If I was strung out on heroin, I could cure it with coke, and, you know, I could do the whole cycles round and round. But in the end, I could always drink respectably. I could always go back to my alcohol and drink in public because it's legal and it's okay, and I could have the big parties, and I got to where I was the guy who could down a quart of tequila, you know, doing shots one after another. That is the great thing that I accomplished, you know. But I went as far as you could go to the bottom of the barrel, and I got to the point where I was literally dying. I mean, my liver was extended out. It was, you know, you could knock on my side, hear it, you know, it was just bouncing. And I got to the point where I was, I mean, I went through the whole motions. I became a functional alcoholic. I tried several times to do the straight life where I would quit selling drugs, and I worked for a pool company, and then I started my own pool company, and, you know, but I always kept dabbling back and forth, and I always had my alcohol. And then I got married. I had three children. Let me ask you this, Bob.
Now, you're an American Indian?
Right. Half.
Okay. Oh, half. And okay. Do you believe that culturally that the American Indian has more of a propensity towards alcohol?
Well, I've done a lot of studies on it, because every Indian I know who drank became alcoholic and diabetic. We have a problem with processing sugar, and we have a lack of enzymes that process the sugar properly, and they're just starting to really refine the studies on it. But it's been proven that there's a couple of genes, and the main thing is this thing in the pituitary, I think. I can't remember exactly now, but it has to do with how you process the sugar. And typically you drink one beer or drink five beers and you pee it out. Well, with American Indian, one beer goes straight to the brain, right to the head, you know, and you don't pee any of it out. And that alcohol goes right to your mind. And, I mean, I've been to literally over 200 funerals of friends and families and relatives over the years who were Indian who died from alcohol and drugs, mostly alcohol, primarily alcohol. And it's 500% higher rate of alcoholism among Indians than anybody else. And the big cause of that is the fact that there really was, South American Indians or even Central America, but North American Indians did not use fermented drink. It was very few tribes, a few southern tribes, but 99% did not have any fermented drink in their rituals or ceremonies. So their body was introduced to alcohol about 400 years ago, and they have never, it hasn't adapted. You know, like most cultures have had alcohol in their systems and their bodies and their cultures for thousands and thousands of years, and they can handle it to a certain extent. American Indians cannot handle it, and that's why we all become diabetic. We all become alcoholic. We just cannot touch the alcohol. We have the highest rate. Right now, all the things we have the highest rate of, we didn't even have prior to, you know, the whole change of culture, you know, which is a polite way to put it. But, we have the highest suicide, highest murder rate, highest alcoholism, highest drug abuse, highest heart disease, highest child abuse, elder abuse, wife abuse, you know, you name it, we have the highest of everything. And all of these things go back to alcohol. If you could magically wave a wand and take the alcohol out of Indian country, all of those other things would fall away, because that alcohol became the curse that really brought the culture to our knees, you know. And that's why so many treaties were signed by drunk Indians, you know, and then that's what it's become. You know, the drunk Indian is just a name that people, you know, and if you look at it, it was almost rightfully earned, because we could not handle the alcohol. So it became really ugly, but it's because it just was new. It's something that we do not process. They didn't use sugars. You know, the only sugar, maple syrup was, you know, typical of up in Midwest and stuff. But none of that stuff is part of the culture. And so it really, really took down most of the.
There was
tribes.
Really no sugar. I mean, that's one of the criteria for advanced civilization is the ability to process sugar, and you really had no ability to process any sugar.
Exactly. Exactly. And it took its toll, you know. And so you couple that with the blood dilution project, and then the where they took all the children from their parents, put them in boarding schools, you know, and stripped them down, cut their hair, beat them if they spoke the language, and it created intergenerational dysfunction. And now you have generations of people, of Indians, who think that is part of their culture. When somebody dies of alcoholism, they think it's proper to go on at the funeral and go to the grave and pour, you know, take shots and get drunk on the grave and pour alcohol in the grave for the dead person, you know, and they think that's part of their culture. They don't even know it's so far removed from reality anymore. So we're actually trying to do one of the things that I work on is bringing back the culture, because the culture is almost the only thing that can really save, you know, bring back what's the dignity that we lost. So that was what got me, and I didn't even know it. I had no idea what hit me, but it hit me hard and it hit me long. You know, I mean, it, and like I said, over 200 funerals. I was trying to write a list a while back so I could kind of the names of all the people I went to, and I lost it at about 210. I know there's more, but I can't remember. And it's just
so. What happened now? To get back to your story now, okay? So you're drug dealing. You're every father's nightmare. You get kicked out of. You get kicked out of school. Oh yeah, you said like somebody I would have hung with. So you got kicked out of school. You manipulated the nuns to kick you out of school because it was a better market in the public school system.
Well, and it was, you know, the public school was right a block away from my house. I was being bused 20 miles down the road to the Catholic school, and I was telling my parents, you know, I'm going to save you money. It's free. You don't have to drive me anymore. You don't have to pick me up anymore. You don't have to pay any money. I'm doing you a big favor, you know. And
how old are you now? What, 15, 16? How old are you?
Let's see. I was about 15 or 16 is when I got kicked out.
Okay.
And literally, this is in my book too. The reason I did it, the reason I blew up the bathroom, you know, of all the things to do, was my religion teacher, a nun. She said. And this is God's honest truth. She said one day, she hears rumors that there are certain kids at this school who don't want to be here. Well, we don't want kids who don't want to be here. We want everybody happy here. So there's two ways you can get out of here. Come and talk to me. I will talk to your parents. We can peaceably settle this thing and get you to go where you want to go so you don't disturb the. And I knew she was talking directly to me because I was a troublemaker. And she said, or you can just go blow up the bathroom and we'll kick you out. Well, I said, God, I love the second one.
That was the wrong statement, sister.
Yeah, sometimes I think back and I think she knew what she was doing, you know. And so we were always bringing back, you know, like quarter sticks of dynamite and stuff from Tijuana and stuff. So I put together this massive bomb with a cigarette fuse, and I put it in the bathroom, in the toilet, and my classroom was between, there was the bathroom, then there was the storage room, the sports storage room next to that. And then my classroom was next to that. So I put the cigarette thing and then went into class. And literally, I mean, before the bell even rang, this thing, it was like ba-boom. And the pictures came off the wall in the classroom I was in. And it took out the whole sports room. I didn't realize how powerful it was. I didn't think it was going to be that powerful. You know, I was lucky I didn't get any people. I was going to say,
what if somebody was in there? That would have been the end of that show.
If you look at the stuff that happened in my life, the fact that, you know, I'm sure there are casualties. Just the fact that I sold drugs, there are definite casualties. But the things that happened to me, the fact that I'm still alive is beyond miraculous. And that's why I have this real strong need to give back, because I've got to be here for a reason. And it certainly wasn't to be a complete loser, you know. So it just spurs me on, because I should have died many times, and a lot of people around me should have died many times too. But, I mean, literally, the principal was knocking on that classroom door within 2 seconds. Like, he knew. They knew. Everybody knew. And so the religion teacher was right. I mean, she was right. I got kicked out right away. I never came back. And that was the turning point in my family life. That was when I basically traded a really good Norman Rockwell experience for hell on earth. You know, when they just shut me down. And it never, obviously it's really good now, and it got good after I became sober years ago, but for the longest time I was definitely the black sheep of the family, you know, beyond black sheep. It was bad. So, anyway.
Okay, so now how old are you? Six, okay, you're in the public school. You're doing your deal there. You're selling drugs and being the head guy there. I could see your pictures. You're pretty muscular, strong kind of guy. So I take it you're pretty tough and you make things happen.
Well, at the time I wasn't. I was pretty scrawny still back then. But it doesn't matter when you've got that kind of, and then literally, you know, if you're a drug dealer, you've got power, and it's unearned power. And unearned power is even worse than earned power because you really flaunt it. And, yeah, I was pretty much a hellion. I mean, I was actually very friendly. I was not a mean person, you know, unless somebody double-crossed me or something like that. But I pretty much kept the entire Southern California, North San Diego County was all mine. You know, I didn't let anybody infringe on my area at all. You know, a couple of friends went to prison, and they went to prison for minor things like marijuana, and they came out, and they were able to manufacture methamphetamine. So, you know, they learned that in prison. So we set up labs, and, you know, we went whole hog. You know, it's like the Jimmy Buffett song. I had enough money to buy Miami, but you know, I pissed it all away. You know, I did everything I could possibly do to buy happiness, and I never found it. You know what I mean? I was happy every night and hungover every morning. And then it was easy to figure the cure for my hangover was to stay drunk, and that worked real well. But it was the alcohol that, in the end, with all the playing around with the drugs, the alcohol in the end that was killing me. I mean, literally killing me. I was not able to. I got to the point where I could not quit, and it really bothered me. It really made me mad because I wanted to control. I wanted to control everything, and I could not control this drinking. I quit everything else. And I got to the point where I'm running my pool business, I'm married, I got three kids, and I'm trying to live this normal life, and I could not, I try to get my work done early in the morning, all the, you know, talk to clients, anything that dealt with the public, over with as soon as possible, so that when I started drinking, I wouldn't have alcohol in my breath, I wouldn't have to talk to anybody, you know, I could hide it, you know, and I actually thought I was hiding my alcoholism, and I was just a rage, I was just, the minute, it got to the point where my drinking, there was nothing. I was chasing. I could not get happiness. I could not get a smile. I couldn't get that buzz back. It was gone. All I got was anger. I took a drink and I got mad and I got madder and I got madder. And I was drinking a minimum quart of tequila every day, you know. And that's what I knew, just to get the day started, you know. And it was taken. I finally got to the point where I was just literally, you know, I was giving up. I couldn't quit. I knew nothing. I never heard of AA. I never heard of any of that stuff. You know, and I never heard of that. I had never, in all the circles I'd been around, I'd never heard of anything like that. And so I figured there is nothing I can do, and I gave up. And then, you know, a few things fell into place where an old friend from the res that I used to drink with in the reservation became the tribal chairman out there. And there was a big wildfire that had burned through the reservation, and there was a hotshot Indian firefighter from Picaris Pueblo out in New Mexico that had come out, and he had died fighting the fire, and he became like a cult hero. It's a whole story that goes with when he died, something that happened back home, and all this stuff. So he called me up and said he wanted me to make a memorial for this kid who died, and it was a big deal. It was like it's still there. It's up on Palomar Mountain. It's a turnout on the road, and the county paved the whole thing and then put up signs, and I built this giant monument, and it was based on the Picaris Pueblo tribe, and it had a big brass insignia on it. And we put, you know, I did it as Southwest as I could, you know, it's sticking to what they sent me. And then we had a big grand opening and everything, and of course I was drunk for the opening for it and everything, and made a fool of myself then. But when I was building that, I felt that this was going to be my salvation somehow. This building, this was going to help me, and you know. And then all it did is gave me a real pretty place to get drunk, you know, up on top of this mountain, and every day I just got drunk. And I that was when I started really falling apart. And I would lay up there after everybody left and cry, and I was realized I was going to die. I was going to die a hopeless drunk, and I'd given up. Few things fell into place when I finished the memorial. They asked me, how much do we owe you? And I said, you don't owe me anything. I said, just give me the key to the Indian Gate, which is a campground, which is that same campground that I'd walked up to that day when I was 14 and met that medicine man. And he said, give me the key to that because I'm going to put up a teepee down there. And I didn't even know what I was talking about. It was like just, I didn't even know where it came from that I even said that. And they were laughing because nobody around, the tribes around here, there's no teepees. This is not Plains Indians. It's Southern California Mission Indians. So there's no teepees or anything like that around here. So they laughed
what did
at
you,
me about
you
it.
You had
so
what, like a Hogan or what
no,
was
the
traditional?
You know, the full, the giant, you know, the big giant teepee, the, you know, 16 foot tall, 32 foot across with the teepee poles and the canvas and everything. And so when they laughed at me that I said that, then it became a challenge. I said, okay, I'm going to do this. So I started looking around. I couldn't find anybody make teepees. And one connection led to another, and I ended up talking to a Navajo woman in New Mexico who made teepees. And she's part of the Native American Church, which I also had never heard of. So she starts on the teepee, and she calls up, and she said, who is the sponsor for the meeting? So it turns out, and I didn't know this, when you order a teepee, when you have a teepee made from the Native American Church, that means that you are going to sponsor a meeting. And the meeting is, it's a Native American Church ceremony, which has been going on for thousands of years. Same ceremonies always. Actually, it's when they do it for drugs and alcohol, when they do a ceremony for drugs and alcohol, it's called the 12-hour, 12-step program. And so what you do is you go in at sundown, pray all night, and you pray for whatever the sponsor. The sponsor is the person who sponsors the meeting for whatever reason, whether it's for sobriety or for a birthday or for education or for a guy going off to war or somebody who died, whatever the reason, that sponsor sits in the sponsor seat and everybody prays for that prayer the whole night. You're in there for 12 hours, sundown to sunrise, all night long. And so I didn't know, and I said, I don't know. I maybe we'll have it for the kid who died or something. I don't know. So anyhow, that was my 40th birthday coming up. And every year on my birthday, I had a huge party with live bands and all the tequila in the world and open bar and everything else. So I had another one planned, and I made up my mind that I was going to drink myself to death at this party. This was going to be my last party, and I'm going to keep drinking until I die. You know, and so I got enough cocaine there so that I can't stop drinking, you know, so I can keep going, and just planned on drinking myself into oblivion. And so we had the party that night, and I kept going. And at the end of the night, towards morning, the cops came, and they shut the thing down. And so I was sure it was the neighbors that had called the cops. So I'm down in the field below my house throwing rocks at the neighbor's window, and my 18-year-old son comes running down the hill and tackles me and throws me on the ground and scares me. He says, enough is enough. I'm sick of you. And I looked up at him and I said, you know, I'm thinking, what do I say? I've got to come up with another story. And I said, I swear I'm going to quit drinking. I've got some Navajos coming out and they're going to pray for me in the teepee. You know, and he just, you know, even in the dark, you could see him roll his eyes. Like another story from this drunken dad of mine. And so then the next day, I survived. I didn't die. I actually didn't even have a hangover. I was so drunk the next day. So I called her up, and I said, okay, I'm sponsoring the meeting for my sobriety. And she said, oh, good. And so word went out that there was a ceremony for sobriety, which is big. It's not that often that people will call for a sobriety ceremony. And so we go out. They deliver the teepee a few weeks later. And my wife's going to leave me, the kids hate me, the house is gone, everything's you know, my life is gone, it's over. And so I went into that teepee, and people came out of the woodwork. People literally drove 18 hours from all over the place and filled that teepee with like 45 people. And all these people did that night was pray for me to get sober, and that's all they did. And it brought me to my knees in humility. That no, these strangers are praying for a stranger for his sobriety for no other reason than to help me, you know. And so I went in that teepee just a dying drunk, and I walked out. And here's where the 13th step comes from in my book.
Sure.
And this goes way back. When you sit in the sponsor seat, you're 12 steps from the door. You're sitting on the door faces the east. You're sitting on the west side right next to the cedar man who holds the cedar, and then the road man who runs the ceremony, and then the drummer's next to him. When you get up and walk out, you take 12 steps to the door, and then you take your 13th step outside that door. And what they say is it snows that night, and your tracks are covered, and your past is gone. And when you step out that teepee, you're making new tracks, and your old ways are over. And so sure enough, that night it actually did. And where it snowed here, is it almost never does. You know, the elevation's too low. But it snowed like crazy that night. And I walked out that morning, and I took my 13th step out at sunrise, right into that fresh snow. And I to this day, I never drank again. That was the end of my drinking. So that's what that's the 13th step. That's the story of my book. And I would love to say that that was it. That was the last time I did anything. But I can't. And that was actually the beginning of, because what happened after that was I never drank again. To this day, I never drank again. But I had an arrogance, and I got to the point where, you know, there was a guy sitting next to me who said, "This is really good." He said, "And you need to follow this up with AA. You need to start going to meetings after this regularly." He said, "To maintain your sobriety." I didn't know what he's talking about. I had no idea. And I just said, "I don't need any of that." And so as I went along, and it literally took away the desire to drink. I mean, literally took it. I just lost it. It was gone. And so I thought, oh, I cured myself. I did it. It's me. It was all about me. It wasn't about God. It wasn't about the prayer. It wasn't about those people helping me. It was about me. And that arrogance, it became my downfall. And a few years later, I had back problems. I always had back problems. But now that I wasn't self-medicating, they really got bad. And they're saying, I need surgery. I need this. I need that. Well, I got a pain doctor who said, no, you need this non-addictive opiate called Oxycontin. Which is, I'm sure you know, is the most addictive substance.
Oh yeah, I have a friend of mine still on it. He's in recovery, but he's got a great story, but he doesn't tell his group that he's still on Oxy.
And I didn't either. You know what I mean? But the reality of it is, if you're on Oxy, you're not clean because it's synthetic heroin. The book I'm writing now is actually all about Oxycontin because it blew my mind to find out the whole story on this stuff because it's just incredible, the whole deal behind it. But anyway, I started off, you know, with Vicodin, and then they got me an eye. And then I had one of those doctors who, you know, you say you need more, he gives you more. And so it took me a couple of years, but I worked my way up to about 800 milligrams a day that I was snorting of this Oxycontin. Just from, you know.
Wow.
And it was, you know, it was legal. It was a doctor prescribing it. It was all kosher, you know. I mean, I was taking what was being prescribed. And then, of course, I started buying it off the street because that wasn't enough. I started, you know, doctor shopping. I started doing everything. And then if I'd run out, I'd have to get heroin just to hold me off till I could get more. And it got uglier than it ever was. I mean, uglier than the whole 26 years it got within a couple of years. And it was.
But you didn't drink. You weren't drinking, though.
No, never had the desire. Didn't. And so this whole time, I'm convincing myself that everything's okay. I'm taking a doctor's prescription. You know, I've got back trouble. I've got no options here. This is what I got to do. And I was eating up literally tens of thousands of dollars. You know, eating up my company, eating up everything. Fortunately, at the time, this was the boom years, and there was enough money. But I mean, I could be retired quite healthy right now if I never went through that. And I went through two home detoxes, and the guy would come over, and for $3,000, he gives you Suboxone, and he takes you through this detox, and you sign the first day that you're going to do 90-90. You're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And you have to sign it, but he doesn't follow up. He doesn't care. As long as he gets his $3,000, he doesn't care what you do. So he never followed up on any of that. I didn't go to meeting one ever. Matter of fact, I did go to one meeting during the insanity of it. And it was a huge group. I was out on the reservation, and everybody was going around the room, and it was almost my turn to talk. And I'd already conjured up in my mind how I was going to tell the story of my sobriety and not mention the fact that I just snorted a pound of, you know, I mean, not a pound, a pile of crushed up Oxycontin before coming into the meeting. You know, fortunately, the meeting ended before it came to me because it would have just been humiliating to what I was going to say was such a lie. But anyhow, so I went through two home detoxes, and that, at the minute I ran out of Suboxone, I immediately relapsed back on it. I mean, that Oxycontin brought me to my knees. I mean, I've never had anything so powerful, so overpowering, and just, you know, it made the alcohol look like lightweight. It was so, you know, and the detox from it, the withdrawals, it's just, within an hour, you're just sweating bullets. So I finally got to the point where I was once again dying, you know, suicidal, and I could not stop. And I would sit around at night, you know, I never slept, and I would just cry and go, how did I get back into this? What did I do? And so I find, in the meantime, I had bought a ranch up in this, up in the High Sierras, 200 acres out in the middle of nowhere. All these things had happened. So I finally said, okay, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I'm going to go cold turkey up at my ranch and get and be done with this. I have to do this because obviously the Suboxone is not going to work. Nothing else is going to work. I got to do this myself. So I went up there. I brought enough stuff for a month. It's a six-mile dirt driveway, literally the middle of nowhere. It's off the grid. You know, we have our own pumping water. We have solar, generator, all that. And the day after I got up there, they had the biggest snowstorm that they've had in probably 30 years. And I didn't sleep. I was going through withdrawals, the beginnings of withdrawals, just the bare beginnings. And the house got – I literally had to tunnel out of the house. There was so much snow. Big drift covered the whole house. So I was trapped. There was no way I could get out. I mean, literally that the road had 4 feet of snow all the way back. So I wasn't going anywhere for at least a few weeks. And it kept snowing. It snowed every day. So I was trapped. And I went through – literally went through hell on earth. I went through a withdrawal that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. I mean, I lost 60 pounds.
Could have killed you, couldn't it? I mean, kind of withdrawal.
Now that I know, heart attack. Oh, God.
Grand mal seizure. I mean, you got, you know, you're right there. I mean, there's nothing to take you down. I mean, that's it. You're cold.
No, it was, and literally, you know, and what I know now, I would never have done it. But you know, it's the best thing that happened to me because, I mean, as far as I know, I did die. I mean, I went into, I would knock out for hours and then wake up cold sweat. I was crapping and puking and you know, my clothes were everywhere. The whole house stunk. I couldn't eat. The food went bad. The pipes froze. I ran out of firewood in a week, so I'm freezing. It's like 10 degrees on a warm day, you know, usually below zero on most days. I had a little tiny propane heater that I would carry around, and I would lean it up against me, and my down jacket, I still have it. It's all duct tape because it melted. It just kept melting this down jacket just to try to keep warm. And so I'm shaking from that, shaking from withdrawals. You know, and I read this thing before I left, and it says, oh, it'll be like 3 days of the flu. Don't worry about it. And, I mean, I want to tell you, it was 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, I was still unable to walk. I could not. And I had horses I had to take care of in Buffalo that I had to walk out because the caretaker took off when I came in. And so he got snowed out, so I had to take care of the animals. It would take me all day to walk down to the barn through the snow, throw the hay over the fence, rest for about 2 hours, and then crawl back up there and lay back down again. But I couldn't sleep. You know what I mean? I was just going through literally hell. So one day, about 2 weeks into it, and I'm just literally dying. I'm going, I've got to get out of here. This, you know, I can't go through with this. I got to get help. I had a satellite phone that would work for about 10 minutes a day, and I was very rarely able to get it, you know, be awake or coherent enough to use it. And I would always try to call my wife, and then it would get knocked out, you know, as quick as it could. I'd get a few words in, and then I'd lose the connection. And so I came in one day after feeding the animals, and I did have TV up there. I had satellite TV. And so what you'd have to do is you start the generator, because obviously solar is not working at all. You start the generator, then you go in, and then you turn on the little dish receiver, and then you wait for that to download all the programming, and then you go through the channels and find a channel. So it was about an hour's process just to turn on the TV. So one day, so I came in about 2 weeks into this, and I am dying. I wanted to die. I would have preferred dying at that point. And I came in, and I started the generator up, and I come inside, and the TV's on, and it's on this, the evangelical, one of those, the TV preachers.
Sure. What do they call it, Harold? Trinity Network.
Trinity Broadcast Network. So yeah, there's a guy talking on there, and I'm not paying attention to it at all. And I'm going, wow, TV's already on. And I come in, and all of a sudden he starts talking. He says, "Hold everything." And this is truth right here. He's talking, and then it catches my attention. He says, "Hold everything." He says, "We have to stop right now and pray." So there's a man right now in California who is withdrawing from OxyContin in a mountain cabin, and he needs our help. I get goosebumps when I tell this story. And,
wow.
And he started praying, and when he started praying, I started convulsing, and I was throwing up, and I mean, like being thrown around the room. And you could hear, I could feel him praying. I mean, it was unbelievable. And so this went on for a while, and then boom, it was gone. The TV went blank. I passed out, slept for the first time in 2 weeks for about maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours. And I woke up, it's the middle of the night, and the whole house is thrashed, and I'm a little bit coherent finally. I start thinking back what happened. I said, did that really happen? Or is that just my mind? You know, am I just hallucinating? So anyhow, that weekend, my son, my oldest son, gotten real worried about me, and he's a policeman out here, and he parked his truck and bought some snowshoes and snowshoed in the 6 mile road through the snow. He figured it'd take him 3 hours. It took him 7 hours to get through. The snow was so thick, and it was all powder. So he's sinking to his knees even with snowshoes every step. So he finally gets there. I didn't even know he's coming. All of a sudden, he shows up at the door, and I'm so happy to see him. So we had a great day. We watched the Super Bowl, and it was a good Super Bowl. And then that night it snowed, and it snowed another horrendous storm. And the next day he's got to leave, and I said, you can't leave. It took you 6 hours to get in. It's going to take you 2 days to get out now, because it put in another couple feet of snow. And he said, no, I've got to go. I've got to go, and I can handle it. No big deal. I said, look, let's do this. Go saddle the horses up. We'll ride them as far as they can go, and then you walk from there, and I'll bring the horses back. Because I knew I could sit on a horse. It's not going to take much to sit on a horse.
Right.
So he gets the horses ready. We get up, we take off, and we start going. We didn't even get a half a mile up the road, and the horses were up to their chest in snow. And they're freezing, and they're shaking. And I said, we can't do this to these animals. I said, come back. You're going to have to try and contact your boss. He'll understand. You know, if nothing else, they can send a helicopter. You know, they got the funds to do it. So he said, no, I'm going to go. I can make this, no problem. So he takes off. He won't take any water, won't take any oranges, nothing. He takes off. I turn around and head back, start snowing on me on the way back. Finally get back. The horse is just plodding through. I wasn't even able to take their saddles off. I just let them out into the pen, went back up to the house, and passed out. I wake up several hours later, and I get through on the satellite phone. I ask my wife, I said, have you heard from Elijah? Have you heard from him? No. I said, you better call the police and have them send out a search party, because he's not going to make it.
Wow.
And so that's when I fell to pieces. That's when I finally realized that my addiction is not mine. It's everybody's. I don't live in a vacuum, and now I'm killing my son for my addiction. And I went outside, and I laid in that snow, and I cried for hours. I just, everything that I did wrong, I just put it all out. You know, I was just doing this confession. And I was sure I killed him. I killed my son so that he could come visit his addict father out in the middle of nowhere. And I was just, and there was nothing I could do. There was nothing I could do. I could not, I didn't have the strength. There was too much snow. It was dark. The horses couldn't do it. I couldn't get through on the phone. Nothing I could do. So I just fell apart. And that is when I came to the absolute end of myself. Just completely a speck of a person. You know, and
the bottom, they call it. Yeah, you hit your bottom. That was your bottom.
This was the real bottom. The one that I really needed to hit before but never did. And so at one point I'm laying there, and some man came and picked me up and carried me in the house and laid me on the couch, put a blanket over me, and took off. And that was no man. You know what I mean? I know who that was. Was no man.
That was...
And
yeah.
It was such a powerful experience. And so in the meantime, my son had dehydrated, passed out. He made himself to a little creek, drank as much water as he possibly could, got to his truck, tried to start the truck. We got the truck started, but it was snowed in. The four-wheel drive wouldn't do anything because there was so much snow. So he just sat there, and then unbelievably some lady came by. She had a chain. She yanked him out, pulled him out, and he drove home. So he got home. But that was the change right there. That experience, that was when I realized that I cannot, you know, this can't go on ever again. I can't do this, and my life has been, you know, horrendous. And what I've put people through, you know, my wife to this day, she's still married to me 30 years. You know, she put up with all this stuff. Codependent at its worst.
Bob, tell us, who was the man that came with the, you said you knew who it was. Who was it? Was it Jesus? Was it an angel? Who was it?
It was definitely Jesus. There's no doubt in my mind. I mean, no doubt in my mind. Because of the because when I think of it, when I think of that experience of being lifted, because I was, you know, I was going in and out of consciousness, and I remember it was just this warm, bright, it was like love. It was like being lifted with love. You know what I mean? It was incredible. And I thought, who is this person out here in this snowstorm? And I never said a word, and I laid down, and then, of course, he was gone. But since that day, everything has been different for me, everything. And that's, so when I came back, I stayed there another, I couldn't get out for another couple of weeks, and to the point, you know, I ran out of food, ran out of everything, and but I started to get some strength back. It took me 2 days to drive out. I had to break into a cabin halfway out and sleep in it because I couldn't make the whole way because the chains kept breaking off the truck. And then I finally got almost to the road. They had to come in with a backhoe and plow the road and drag me out. So anyhow, I came back, and my wife took what little money we had left and put me into rehab, into treatment center. I said, I don't need that. And she said, oh, yes, you do. And it was the best thing that happened to me because that's when I realized that I have to turn this around. I have to make sense of all of this. And so after that, that was when, you know, I loved it. I learned everything I could about treatment, about why I do what I do, what's wrong with my brain, where does this addiction come from, why do I do it, why does anybody do it, you know, and learned the whole disease concept. And then learned
about
AA.
Let me ask you this. Let me digress for a second. Now, there was the time between you quit drinking and you were starting to do the Oxy, and you're going to meetings, right? You're going to AA?
Oh,
what are you going to,
no,
AA?
No. No, I wasn't. I wasn't going to meetings.
Oh, you was not? Oh, okay.
Went
so no
one
sponsor,
time,
no
I went,
steps, no nothing.
Nothing, nothing. And that was my... Had I done that, I wouldn't have gone through the Oxy thing. But I needed to go through that Oxy thing because I had an attitude back then that addicts and alcoholics are just weak people, and I was just a weak person, and I needed to be stronger. And I still look down on addicts, especially addicts. And so I became an addict to find out how stupid that kind of thinking is. You know what I mean? And I learned, I have to learn things the hard way. I don't get to learn easy lessons. My lessons have to be the hard way. And so I learned the hard way that I have no right to judge anybody, no right to even make any kind of judgment on anybody about anything they do. And what introduced me to AA was the treatment center I went to. And they had meetings every day, and that's when I learned that the ticket out of this was the 12 steps. This is what was going to, you know, the sponsor, the steps, everything, the meetings, the whole bit. That's what I needed. And that is what made the difference, because the obsession was lifted that night, but the sick mind was still there, and the sick mind is still here now. But I don't have a desire to drink or use, but I still have a sick mind, and I know
how'd you find your sponsor?
Well, I was basically assigned one in rehab, but when I got out, the first meeting I went to on the reservation, I immediately knew. You know, I just had, it was an old Indian guy, and I heard him talk, and he knew, you know, he had like 30 years, and he knew AA so well, you know, and he came up to me after the meeting, and he said, you don't need to call yourself an addict in here. He says, if you call yourself an alcoholic, we know what you are. We don't need to hear all that other stuff. And I said, how about if you be my sponsor? He said, absolutely. So, and he was good. He actually just died about 8 months ago. But he was he was an inspiration because he knew he lived AA. He's one of those AA guys who knows it backwards and forwards. When he was a drunk, and when he got sober, the judge said he had to do 90 and 90. Well, he did four meetings every day for a year.
Wow. What was his name?
I don't know if that's right or wrong or anything, but after he died, I don't use his name anymore, and it's kind of
okay.
An Indian thing. So I just don't bring up his name anymore.
I understand, sure, okay.
But I'll tell you, it was, and so, you know, obviously since then I've got a different one, but he was between him and AA, that was the thing that, you know, brought it all together. And so I realized when I came to the 12th step, that's when I realized, okay, I need to give back because I've been given so much. I need to give back a lot. And so that's when I started writing my book. That's when I went back to college. I got my degree in drug and alcohol counseling. I went through CADAC, got certified by CADAC, became trained as an interventionist, got the book published, and then right now I'm actually starting to. I'm taking over a treatment center over on, up on the same mountain that all the teepee and everything else happened. There's a 67-acre treatment center, a remote treatment center up there, a men's treatment center called Sober Ranch that I'm going to be taking over in September. And it, you know, the book tells you if we help others, we won't relapse. And that's the only hope I got, is to keep helping others. You know what I mean? That if I help others, then I don't have a chance to relapse, because I want to be able to give this away, and I can't give it away if I don't have it. You know, so the fact that I'm able to take this thing over is such a gift. You can't even believe how all this came about. The fact that I'm going to be the one running this treatment center, and it's just a gift. It's something that I could not possibly have put together myself. Could not possibly have dreamed of putting it together myself. And it just landed in my lap. It's just been handed to me, and I'm so excited about it. It just drives me nuts. I go out in a week. I go out to the Southwestern. Oh, what do they call that? It's the Southwestern. Here, I got the book right here. It's called the 45th Annual Southwestern School for Behavioral Health Studies. It's a conference that they have every year out in Tucson, where all the treatment centers from all the Indian reservations and all over the country and other treatment centers get together. So several thousand people come together for this conference and learn new stuff and everything. So last year I did a workshop on my book, and this year they want me back for that. So I'm doing the workshop on the book and also promoting the new treatment center out there and everything else too.
So how do we find your webpage?
The 13thstep.com is my website, and then I'm taking over the Sober Ranch website. It's still not mine, but it will be, and that's just soberranch.com, all one word, all small.
How do you spell the 13th step?
It's basically spelled out, so it's THETHIRTENTHSTEP.com, so the 13thstep.com. And that'll take you to the book. It's available on Amazon. This book has opened more doors for me. I mean, and I want to tell you, when I wrote the book, I'd been taking notes for years and years and years, and then I finally put it all together. When I finally started typing, and I never knew how to type, I couldn't turn on a computer, none of that stuff. So when I learned how to do it, and I would sit up at night. I spent like several months. I just quit doing everything but typing this book out. And what was handwritten for like 3 pages would turn into 5 typed pages. Stuff was just like being downloaded right through me. I mean, the first time I read that book, I wondered who wrote it. I said, where in the world did this stuff come from? I mean, it's got some great stuff in there. I still read it today and get new stuff out of it all the time. So it's geared, it takes you through the Native American church ceremony. It takes you through, the first half is everything that I told you, my life, and then through the ceremony and everything else. And then the next book is going to be, and like chapter 11, inventory, admission, submission, and humility. That's when everything really started happening, you know, in the ceremony. But the next book takes you that next step, that the story that I told you tonight, that nobody even, this is the first time anybody's really heard that whole story. Because everybody thinks my story ends in the teepee, and that I got sober and everything's hunky-dory. But except, of course, obviously, the people in my home group and everything else, they all know my real story, the whole story, you know. But so everybody's going to be shocked when they read my next book, because it takes me right back to the depths of hell again. But I needed, I really feel I needed to do that, because that is what gave me the compassion that I needed to become a counselor, to be able to really give back and to understand what's going on. You know, I needed to be brought to my knees, because I was too arrogant. I thought I was it. You know, I'm the guy. And I found out I'm really not. I'm actually nobody. And, you know, I'm just a hopeless drunk and a hope-to-die drug addict, and I need to help other people, or I'll be one again someday.
I'd like to read the acknowledgement from John Halpern, if that's all right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The story in this book has a purpose about life, meaning that your whole life will be changed to a better way of life because there is a good spirit within us. Translated from the Navajo language. Jerry Edisithi, Sr., Navajo tribe. Is that, what is it? How do you spell it? Say it.
Edisithi. That's right. You got it.
Okay.
Jerry
Navajo tribe, father of the Salt clan, mother of the Left Hand people, roadman and former vice president of the Native American Church of the United States. The 13th step offers a heart-filled story of redemption from the ravages of alcohol. This book is important to read for alcoholics, for those seeking recovery from any substance abuse, for those seeking improved mental health and spiritual health wherever needed, for a doctor and caregivers within the drug treatment programs, and for anyone interested in learning more about Native American religious expression. 12-step recovery programs strive to awaken that sense of goodness in all of in us all, that the Creator loves us and wants us to accept our innate power to make ourselves whole. The 13th step is about that awakening. Robert Hayward is a beautiful writer. I'm a rough and tough reviewer. I never say someone is a beautiful writer unless, quite rarely found, they truly are. Robert has done this story proud. It is incredible what he has written. It is important. John Halpern, MD, Assistant Professor of Psychology, Harvard Medical School, Director of Laboratory for Integrative Psychiatry, Alcohol and Drug Division, Alcohol and Drug Abuse Research Center. Boy, that's a pretty powerful title this man has. Harvard, huh?
Yeah, he's amazing. He's an amazing man. He's part of SAMHSA too. He does all the reviews for, you know, all of the scholarships and grants that go out for SAMHSA for drug and alcohol studies and everything. He did the way I met him is he did a real serious long term study of the Native American Church among the Navajo. He actually went into the ceremonies and everything, and one of the few white people who was ever allowed to actually go in, and he studied it for a long time, and he got it to where in the federal code now for Indian Health Service, IHS, Indian Health Service code, they recommend the Native American Church ceremony as part of treatment for alcoholism, because on the reservations, the Navajo reservation and some of the more remote reservations, there's no AA meetings going on. They just don't exist. But there's ceremonies going on every single Saturday night, so they recommend these guys go into these ceremonies, get involved in that, because it's the same. It's basically the Indian version of AA. It's the fellowship. It's the support. It's the praying together. The whole rigmarole in a more culturally appropriate setting. So I was reading some of his studies, and so I sent him the original manuscript on the book. I didn't hear, and so I figured out, well, you know, I didn't like it. And all of a sudden he calls me and he says, that is the most incredible book I've ever read on this. He said, I didn't think that anybody would ever do this. So I said, well, would you write a review for it? There's actually some more reviews that he's given me. I think they might be in the book somewhere or something. But, yeah, he's a heck of a guy, and he's 100% behind what we're doing, too. He's helped me a lot.
Oh, that's great. Harold, any last words before we close it out?
Well, I just really appreciate the honesty and the authenticity tonight, Bob. It really serves a lot of people. And I'm going to go to the website, grab the book. I do family therapy and also drug counseling in
Nice.
Sugar Land, Texas, at the Houston Center for Christian Counseling.
Great.
And so I go out and do interventions for families, and I just do that as a way of giving back also.
Right.
So,
and the
wonderful
prisons, yeah.
Hearing
and
your story.
To the prisons.
Yeah, I go into the jails and teach recovery.
Nice. Excellent.
I just want to applaud your ability to tell your story and be so humble and transparent, and
really appreciate you coming on the program, and I encourage your listeners, our listeners, to go to, what is it, 13thstep.com?
Yeah, the 13thstep.com, yeah.
Oh, the T-H-E on the beginning of it, the 13th?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
The 13thstep.com, yeah.
All spelled out.
Yeah.
All right. And so I just, I thank God for my recovery and for yours also.
Great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your words.
You know, Bob, I had a thought that might work for you on the, I don't know if you've been to the Rum Radio website, but we have featured posts. And if you'd be interested to write a post.
Oh, I definitely
would. You know, write a post, and then we could put a link to the 13th step from your post.
Okay, great.
So if you take a look at some of that, and so I think that might be a help for the both of us. I'd like to get as much information out as possible. Let everyone decide for themselves what's pertinent and what's not pertinent. You know, I believe that recovery is really about free agency, free will. You know, this is suggested. You have to want it. You know, I like to think of AA is for people who want it, not for just people who need it. If we had everybody who needed it in there wouldn't be room to sit out. You know? So
you could never make it work.
No. No, you gotta want this thing, and it's on it's our experience that it takes what it takes, and that usually means most drugs and alcoholics, or if you're anything like me, or you're a pretty tough guy. And it takes really quite the sledgehammer to get you into, Bill W. used to call it a state of reasonableness, which means you become teachable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is
very
good. Yeah. So yeah, teach. So before I became teachable, I think Harry Truman said is once you know it all, those are the things. After you know it all, those are the things that really count. When you learn the things that really count.
Right.
Anyway,
yep.
So thank you so much. We'll keep in touch. If you can get that post going, you know, we'll put that up, and then we'll put a link, and that'll give you some drive on that. So
great.
Thanks again for your service. Like always, it's always when AA reaches out, we want to know I'm responsible. When
right,
AA
right.
reaches out. We reached out to you, and you said okay, and that's the spirit of the recovery program, to be available to help the next sufferer. Thanks again,
well,
Bob.
I really appreciate it, and I really, really love what you're doing. I mean, I don't have much time to do to search around and stuff like this, but I really love what you're doing because it's awesome. I mean, I'm sure you don't even know how many people you reach, but you reach one and that reaches another. And I know you guys are doing a great thing, so it's excellent, excellent. I really appreciate being allowed to speak on here. So good night.
Thanks for being with us, Bob.
Thank you.
All right. Okay.
In closing, I'd like to say rumradio.org is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages. Probably more than that. I haven't updated the analytics lately. We're over 300,000. We've been over 300,000 for about 700 years, for about 7 months now. So we were probably more than that. Yeah, I always thought 300,000 was a nice round number, but it's probably more than that. We're very popular in Nepal.
Oh.
You know why? Because they like our yak. It's a good for sponsorship. This is really good information. We've had big book thumpers, dyed in the wool big book thumpers go through this thing with a fine tooth comb and tell me you're right on point. This is exactly okay. This is big book and 12 and 12. We don't need anything else. That's sufficient. Bill W. said in his last address, AA will change. AA must change. The message will not change. We have the right message. What changes is the way we get it out, the presentation,
and the delivery of the message. That's the change. Rum Radio represents part of that change. It works when you work it. So we keep it right close to the vest, but this, it's fun, it's spiritual, and it's program. So remember, like usual, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.